Speaking of Reliability, a podcast with good friends talking with you about reliability engineering topics. Welcome to Speaking of Reliability. This is Fred Schenkelberg.
And this is Chris Jackson. And today we're going to be talking about what redundancy can do to the culture or the mindset of organizations who, for example, manage plants or have very complex systems that need high reliability or uptime to be profitable.
Yeah, and this was sparked by a listener's question. And it was, we had to break it down a little bit, but it was, do you do redundancy or you do reliability in your systems? And how's this, I'm going to make it more vague than what he asked, is how's this relate to maintenance? And I think you were talking, Chris, when we were off air, and I said, we better hit record, that sometimes having redundant systems allows the team to slack off on maintaining the equipment, because you can run it to failure and you have a redundant part that'll cover it. And I don't know that that's always a good thing.
No, and there is a very relatively well-known example is in the early 2000s and 2010s, the Royal Australian Navy was quite well-known for its approach to redundancy, in that you might have vessels and ships which have triple redundant systems, and they would put to sea if only one of those things was working. And essentially the whole attitude to engineering and maintenance disappeared because, it's redundant. So if one fails, it doesn't matter. But the reality is, with cost margins and operating profiles, and especially for vessels and ships, the weight budget's so tightly constrained that if you have a triple redundant system, it's usually there for a genuine response to a demand on risk during design, as in the system is so crucial that failure is not an option, so you have a triple redundant design, or could also be to save space. That's more like a K out of N system, where if you need to have 150 gallons per minute pumps, then having 350 gallon per minute pumps can often be a way of just making better use of space. There's all sorts of reasons why a design team would have a triple redundant system in the original blueprint, and it's not just a nice to have. So the way that these redundant systems were influencing culture was that, there's two back up anyway, so we don't really need to maintain. We can put to sea with, a lot of stuff not working. And as a result, the culture was terrible, absolutely terrible, until it got to the point where a couple of vessels were floating aimlessly across Sydney Harbour when they're supposed to be online and responsive to a cyclone up north. And that's when the lid was lifted and this gross culture of trying to minimize any accountability or level of effort to maintain things was discovered.
Yeah, and I've run into something similar where a company says, well, that was a vendor problem. And, it's not our problem, it's the vendor problem. It says, your customer called you about it. It's your problem. Yeah. It's like, just because you can find another reason not to do something doesn't mean it's the right thing to do. But when Carl's question had the element of maintenance in it, and that example you gave really ties into it. Mm-hmm. But it's also sometimes like redundant pumps, like we have here in our water system where I live, it allows you to replace seals and do the lubrication and check out all the maintenance tasks that go with maintaining a pump while the other pump's doing its business and
right.
We don't have to shut it down. Now, we don't technically need a redundant system at our plant because I think it only needs to run like 4 or 5 hours a day to keep up with demand. And we have a limit of how much water we can store. So running more just gets wasted. And so there's plenty of downtime for that to happen. Yet the redundancy there is it has the benefit of allowing us to do maintenance without having to worry about schedule and stuff like that. It's more that if we lose a single point or single pump, that's a single point failure in our system, we run out of water in about a day.
Right.
So it was redundant because just getting something fixed takes time. It's not like we have, you know, a whole warehouse full of extra pumps around here.
Yeah. And so there's obviously two ways it can go. It's you can have redundancy to, which then has a very negative impact on culture and reliability. Then you can also have redundancy inbuilt the way you've talked about, Fred, with a very proactive mindset, if for nothing else, to allow maintenance to occur on one pump while a redundant system or redundant, you know, maintenance to occur on one subsystem while the other redundant subsystem is happily chugging away, to feasibly allow, you know, a state of constant uptime. So I think, unfortunately, a lot of times it's the former. We have, and I see it in reliability techs as well, and when we talk about the dreaded reliability prediction, mm-hmm. and I've seen it be formally advised that you don't need to specify high reliability performance if you've got redundancy. And again, it's just the designers, if they can get away with not having redundant systems, they will. So the fact they have them doesn't give operators or the spare parts team or whoever doesn't give them carte blanche to try and find ways to cut corners, cheapen everything, just get rubbish involved because there's redundancy. Even though I've seen so-called reliability engineers advocate that having redundancy becomes a sort of trigger for dropping of standards.
Yeah. No, I've run into that too. And it's part of the decisions I've run into is it's the supply chain thing. It's, well, we can get five cheap pumps and store five extra cheaper than getting one pump that's really good. And I'm like, okay, that makes sense. And you might have a 4 out of 5 system, okay, out of N types redundancy, and a whole bunch of spares. And then what I saw, and the reason I got called into it, was they also forgot to make it easy to swap them out. They didn't make it, the plumbing was such that you had to take apart 3 pumps just to get to the one that failed. And of course, the one that was buried was the one that failed for whatever reason. Right. And it was like, what are you thinking? If, you know, you got to think through the design to include maintainability in that kind of case. But you know, looking at Carl's question again, there was this predictive maintenance element he put in there. And I'm thinking, I've always thought that was a pretty poor name because I can predict that next Tuesday I'm going to go do some maintenance on something independent of whether it's needed or not. But what I think most people refer to it as is that you have some sensoring or monitoring or some way to say, this thing's about to fail. There's a buildup of corrosion, there's a lack of power, there's whatever it is, and we can monitor that and see the degradation. And then we can say, all right, by 2 months from now, we're going to have to swap this out or do something about it. And redundancy helps in that regard because then you can plan it on the day you want to do it rather than waiting for a downtime for some other reason or, you know, especially if you're trying to do a factory and you don't want to interrupt production for a preventative maintenance type activity. I get that. But the culture part of it is an interesting twist because I've seen teams actually do really well with not all of the technicians I worked with, but some of them. And when I worked with these escalators, they were repairing and maintaining escalators in a public transit system. And one of the major events, and very costly, is that when you had to replace the chain that is connected to all the steps in this escalator. And right. I never realized how much chains stretched. I knew rope stretch, but I didn't know chains would do that too. And apparently under load, they do stretch. And once they get too much stretch in them, the gap between the treads on the staircase is big enough that you could get trapped, you could get caught in it, and then it's a bad thing for your foot or whatever got caught in it. And so they would routinely monitor that gap, and as it started, as the chain would stretch, that gap would get bigger. And it, one of the ideas was, well, it's every time you go out to do regular maintenance on it, measure it, you know, actually measure it, not just do a check or like a go, no guy check, but what is the rate of stretch that's occurring? And I thought, well, we could set up a predictive maintenance thing. If it's at this rate of stretch for this particular machine in this particular location, then we could schedule pretty accurately when we needed to go replace it. Because it took 2 or 3 months lead time to get the replacement chain in a good day. And so there I thought the culture was, most of these guys did not want to replace chains because it's like a full day, very dirty job. It's not an easy thing to do. And so it was like, the less I need to do this, the less I have to think about it. The less I, you know, I'm not going to do this so that it's easy because I don't want to do it. And some of the technicians were, no, it's a safety issue. We need to replace it as soon as it's there, instead of taking the system offline completely. And then you had redundancy because there's another escalator down the concourse a little ways and down the platform a little ways. And it really ties into that person's attitude towards, do we want to maintain these things so they're up and running and safe? And then they have an out because there's usually two sets of escalators and they have a redundant part of it. And I see where, looking back on it, that that's where that ability of redundancy degraded the care for the maintenance.
As a slight aside, one of the other reasons I like, you know, advocate for the whole don't just test go, no, go the way you're talking about. Mm-hmm. By that you mean, just to, for our listeners, obviously there is some level of stretch that those chains can't go beyond. As soon as they go beyond it, they're now defective or whatever you want to call them.
And yeah, it's a safety problem. And their policy was, if it gets too big, then you just shut it down, wait for the parts to come in.
Right. But as soon as you start measuring, and it just opens the door for other conversations to happen as well. So for example, if you know the chains are stretching, a millimeter a month or whatever the mm-hmm. thing is, and say, okay, well, that means that every 13 months we need to change the chains. Well, then you can say, well, okay, let's go back to our suppliers. Is it possible to pay extra or to change, you know, the material to have the rate at which those chains stretch over time smaller? So it might cost an extra couple of $1,000 for a chain which has a stretch rate that's smaller.
But it lasts 5 years longer, yeah.
Right. And without saying there is an answer or there isn't a solution, it just starts people thinking in a way that I think is very healthy. And of course, everyone says, oh, no, you just buy from the suppliers and the chain is the chain. And that's never the case. It is never the case that there is no other alternative. And you could even put it to the, like, if you realize that, you know, every time we change it has to change a chain, it costs X $100,000 or whatever the price right. might be. Right. You say, well, we'd be prepared to pay an extra whatever price it is for a much higher quality chain. Let's start talking about that. But that's a whole new podcast. But every time you start measuring things, good things happen.
That's what I thought. And I think 3/4 of the techs just, no, you use the number 2 pencil. If it goes in the gap, that means we have to replace it soon. And I said, you know, the ones downtown, they get heavy traffic day and night, and we reverse the directions on them to accommodate the traffic patterns, the flow of people. They get loaded way heavier and way more often than the chains that are way out at the end of the system that, you know, maybe 200, 300 people use, or however many that is. But it's once in the morning and once in the afternoon, and that's it. And I said, you know, measuring it would help us. One, we already know where the big traffic is, and we know that those chains, because of the loading, they stretch at a different rate versus the ones way out somewhere else. And just as you said, is once we start measuring it, then we know the lead time for the ones in town with the heavier loads is, we got to have those within a month or two. So we, as a minimum, Whereas the ones way out on the fringes of the system, they're not loaded near as heavily, so they could last probably a year before we need to change that one. But right now we're blind to that because we don't have the measurements being taken. And so that was my argument for it. And but the cultural part of it was, no, you just take the system down and I can spend more time maintaining the other one. This is, and I've been on some of those maintenance jobs with them. And it was like, will you do that when people need the escalator? You know, if you only have one left, what are they going to do?
Yeah.
There's only a limited capacity in the elevators and the stairs. That's not a good plan.
No. So, bring it back to redundancy and effective predictive maintenance. Well, predictive maintenance is also a largely cultural thing as well, I'd argue. Mm-hmm. I mean, people who take maintenance very seriously, they're more likely to have predictive maintenance as how they roll.
And do it well versus saying, oh, we'll just put sensors on everything and then we'll be fine and then don't analyze it.
Right. Going back to the Australian military as an example, there's when this whole idea of health and usage monitoring came out, essentially it was just have a data logger of all this stuff. And then they started demanding that all these systems have health and usage monitoring systems on their vehicles and mm-hmm. weapons systems and everything else. Great. But there was no plan to use that data ever.
Yeah. Buying the shiny new thing is kind of, I've seen that in so many different ways.
Yeah, actually, I remember the main reason health and usage monitoring systems were used, at least in my time in the military, was to help investigate vehicle accidents to work out what speed
the driver like a was black, actually going. Little back box going there.
Yeah, that was the main use. But all this wonderful new age of smart maintenance, we just want to have it on there so it's part of the glossy brochure, but no one actually used it. They still serve at fixed intervals. No budget for that. So anyway.
Now the ones that are serious, I'm thinking of the big server farms for business, you know, when they're dealing with transactions and stuff. I'm thinking like Amazon or a big online store like Walmart's and systems like that. They're way beyond just redundancy. It's got to be resilient. It's got to have so much capacity that even if we have to use all the servers from somewhere thousands of miles away, we can still do it. Because they're designing for natural disasters and major power outages and all kinds of weird things that happen that are beyond the pale for a small pump house and water treatment plant that I have. Yet they also know that for every minute of downtime they have, it costs X amount of dollars to them. So it's economical for them to get fanatical about uptime.
Right.
Whereas I'm thinking of factories, car factories, or even I was in a canning plant, you know, a couple of years ago for like soups and drinks and stuff like that. They were basically set up with very modest amounts of redundancy. I'm thinking of the canning machine I saw it, and I think it had 100 different spigots or whatever they called it. So these jars would come into it and it'd go under a nozzle and it would get filled. And as it's getting filled, it takes time. And it's spinning pretty fast. They were able to have 100 ports there. So it's not like just one got filled and it moved on. They were rolling them into this carousel and mm-hmm. they'd go around the way and then come off full and get their cap put on it and off they go. But it allowed them to do on the order, depending on what they're filling, up to like 1,000 a minute. This thing was flying. It was just absolutely a marvel to watch. Also, you wanted to keep your fingers in your pockets kind of thing.
Right.
And they had guards and barriers and stuff like that all over the place. But this thing was just flying. And if they had a failure, if there was a mechanical failure or whatever, they had a modest amount of redundancy. They could meet their production quotas if they were filling only 90 bottles a minute or something like that. Uh-huh. And or whatever. They had some slack in what their throughput was. The machine would run the same rate, but it would just skip it would have it wouldn't put a empty bottle in the slot that wasn't going to fill it. But there was so many other spots that were single point failures. And so part of the project was there's two pieces of equipment on here that break down quite a bit and are causing a lot of backlog and stuff like that. Should we put two complete lines in parallel or just put in parallel these machines and then the extra costs of switching units and stuff like that and the conveyors and everything else? And after being with them for about a week, it was pretty obvious that they just needed to figure out how to set up their machines, because they were looking at their data and watching the equipment as they'd set up to do an 8-ounce bottle or whatever size they were filling that day. And it would take them 2 or 3 days to get it to run well. They were constantly tweaking stuff and adjusting stuff and, you know, changing the conveyor belt baffles and all this other stuff. And the first day was a disaster. And so they had a policy of, well, we're going to run for 2 weeks or a minimum of a week for whatever we're doing, because the changeover just is too costly in our in the hit to throughput. And then I talked to the guy that was running the warehouse. He says, we're running out of space, because every time they introduce a new flavor or introduce a new bottle size, we have to add another 2 acres of warehouse. And he said, if we could do quick changeovers and get it right from the start, we wouldn't need all this redundancy and, you know, all these other things like that. It's just, we got to get the machines right.
Right.
And so the recommendations were, dial in your settings and lock them in place, you know, so that you, when you change from an 8 to a 12 ounce, you go click and you're in and you're done. I'm quite sure it's not that simple, because I'm quite sure there's plenty of thermal effects and all kinds of seasonal things that occur and variations of the bottle sizes that matter and on and on and on. But it's like, this is ridiculous. You have operators out here with ball-peen hammers adjusting the baffles so that, that you can feed this, these cans down the line the right way. That shouldn't be happening.
Yeah.
And other simple stuff, like they couldn't find the tools they needed. They, you know, they were collecting, I think the bottling machine itself had somewhere on the order of like 2,000 or 3,000 sensors on it that were measuring all kinds of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, nobody ever looked at it. They thought, no, that's not useful. But the guy that running the IT department was quickly running out of server space and memory space. This is a while ago, but he was just like, we're paying a fortune to store all this stuff. I wish somebody'd use it.
Right. Yeah. So just like the Miami experience. Yeah. So, I mean, going back to Carl's question, which is, you know, how does redundancy and predictive maintenance align? I think we've talked about how redundancy can often sort of make organizations culturally numb to taking it seriously.
Mm-hmm.
Other organizations actually aggressively use redundancy to help with things like concurrent maintenance, make sure that there's essentially no downtime while they're maintaining or conducting preventive maintenance on a or predictive maintenance, or just doing whatever they need to do to keep, you know, one of those pumps going.
Mm-hmm.
That's a thing.
We get redundancy back in place as quick as possible, as opposed to, oh, we can wait until they both fail and then we'll get a deal and buy in parts. I see that. That's kind of that culture of, it doesn't matter.
Right. So there's that. I suppose the other thing maybe Carl was getting at was predictive maintenance and redundancy. Predictive maintenance can make reliability go to the roof. So think about a ball bearing, for example.
Mm-hmm.
We know how ball bearings fail. We know we can model their time to fail pretty damn well. But if you want to use fixed interval swap outs of ball bearings, you're still by definition throwing away 95-99% plus ball bearings that were still working at your fixed interval preventive maintenance or scheduled servicing action. So that's always a thing. And you want to avoid that where possible. But even if you have fixed interval servicing or service schedules where you just swap out ball bearings or redo ball bearings every however many cycles, you still are going to have a finite number failing because you need to balance risk. You know, the more you service, the more bearings don't fail due to wear out, but the more you service. And if you want to, you got to try to find the right balance with when you're doing servicing schedule between accepting a certain amount of ball bearings failing in an interval and servicing. Whereas predictive maintenance for example, going to include having vibration sensors on ball bearings to identify that first spalled pit where your ball bearing is still working perfectly fine, but you've just started to incur a little bit of damage on one of those races. And now that legendary PEF curve comes into play and you can say, okay, now we need to swap this ball bearing out for the next 2 weeks and off you go. And I would argue maybe in some cases, you would perhaps not need to have redundancy if you use predictive maintenance, because the predictive maintenance can offer you those huge increases in reliability to the extent you might not need to have a backup. So that might be what Carl's getting at. And if he is, I concur with or understand where he's coming from. I think many people just, the worst case scenario is where they simply go to reliability prediction or tables and get the MTBF or all ball bearings and say, that's how long ours is going to work. And no, that's not the case. Whereas if you need a ball bearing to be very reliable, well, you can essentially have it last a lot longer than what is advertised if you have predictive maintenance where you know precisely when it's going to fail. When I say precisely enough that you can always swap it out before it fails at the right planned maintenance or planned downtime period, to the extent that you might not need to have redundant systems. Now, it's ball bearings are a bad example for redundancy because, as a rule, you don't incorporate redundant ball bearings on a single shaft that can actually mess things up. All of a sudden, if you have two ball bearings instead of one, well, the axial load or transverse load is now being shared between two ball bearings, which was now puts the calculations off. And you know what? When one of those ball bearings fails anyway, it's still on the same shaft. But maybe he's talking about scenarios where predictive maintenance can be applied to scenarios where redundancy might be an option. And maybe pumps is a good example. You can detect vibration and look at the changes in power profiles and throughputs to have a really good idea when cavitation is starting to take out impellers and things like that. To the extent that you might be able to predict failure so well with pumps, you can always swap them out at the last planned downtime period before they fail so that you really minimize failures during operation. So maybe that's where Carl's coming from, and it's also a more than feasible philosophy to have as a designer.
Yeah. One of the things that's underlying that example, Chris, is that everybody involved gets it and understands that that's why we're doing this predictive maintenance and the analysis of that data and taking action, even though it hasn't failed yet. And there's a whole lot of everything's got to work. It has to be a solid system, a solid culture behind it for it to work. Whereas we talked about, it took us almost a half hour to get, I think, to what Carl was talking about in his question. Mm-hmm. We've seen so many other examples where it's just many elements of it just don't contribute to solving that problem or improving the performance of that production or that system. And for all kinds of reasons, but it took us a while to come around to it. I thought we would at one point. I'm glad you got it. But it sounds like a reasonable way to think about it. But I think the barrier is that you need a good maintenance plan. You need a good warehousing and storage and spare parts system. You need good analytics, trustworthy analytics, and the analysis of that data set that comes up, modeling to say, yeah, we got 2 weeks or we got 2 days. And what do we do about that? That kind of stuff, I think, is a lot has to be in place for it to go. And a well-run, well-managed maintenance program coupled with your design can really go a long way. Yeah, there's, so it is possible. I think it could make a lot of sense.
Yeah, because people think that redundancy is awesome, and it certainly can be, but you really don't want to have redundancy if you don't need it. It's if you have a redundant pump or anything, it means you need to have another pump you weren't planning on purchasing and maintaining, and of course that takes up space, and it takes up, you might have a mass budget, and so it obviously contributes to your overall mass. And you want to avoid redundancy if you can, but you also want to find the right balance between if having a redundant system means that it's going to be overall cheaper. Again, you talked about that scenario where people said, well, we can get, you know, maybe a couple or one really reliable pump or a system and versus five very unreliable ones, and actually having five very unreliable ones is a lot less expensive, but they combine to give you a certain reliability. The trick is making sure they're easy to swap in and swap out. Otherwise,
that's the mute point. It didn't work.
That's a different story, though. But
But that's what I mean. It comes down to all teams touching this need to be firing on all cylinders, use an analogy. Otherwise, it's it's just not going to work. Great on paper, but if the team doesn't implement it, it's not going to work. It's not going to meet your expectations.
Well, right.
Anyway, if you're listening to this and you're dealing with redundancy and reliability or maintenance forms in one form or another, or any other aspect of reliability, engineering, quality, safety, risk management, all that kind of good stuff, let us know. This came from a listener and a question they posted to us. We look for yours. What's on your mind? What's troubling you? What are you working on? Any ideas on past episodes? All that good stuff. It's a chance for you to join the conversation. So you can do that by going over to ascendoreliability.com/go/SOR. And you can find a couple of ways to get in touch with us. Chris and I and the other hosts of the show are available through LinkedIn and our about pages on Ascendo. So plenty of ways for you to get in touch. All right. And shout out to Carl. Thanks for the question. And probably see another one from you. I hope this encourages to send us over a few more ideas and we'll see what we can do with it. So thanks so much, everyone, for listening, and we'll catch you next time.
Thanks for listening to Speaking of Reliability. We invite you to join the conversation if you have a question or a topic that you think we should discuss in a future show. Please let us know. You can find a comment box below the episode show notes, or just leave a note as part of a review on iTunes.